Talkback Gardening
on ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill.
Good morning and welcome to Talkback Gardening. Good morning, Brett Draper.
Good morning, Deb. And what a wonderful day it is outside today.
It certainly is. A great weekend for gardeners and a lot happening in the gardening world if you want to get out and enjoy a garden other than your own. Plenty of opportunities to do so. And of course, South Australia and Adelaide, very well known for our roses.
Absolutely. And do you know what? What a wonderful day to go out and smell the roses.
Exactly. And we have got joining us in just a moment one of the state's best roses. And that is Kim Cirrus. And he has recently returned from a Churchill Fellowship looking at rose growing techniques around the world. And I have to say, I got a text saying, oh, Kim, the poor thing, travelling the world looking at roses must be hard. So we'll find out exactly what he's been doing in just a moment. I have a couple of ABC Organic Gardener magazines to give away later in the program. But if you've got a question right now for both Brett and Kim on roses, please call in on 1300 222 891. We'll return to general talk about gardening a little later in the program. But roses are the agenda right now. 1300 222 891. We love your comments as well on the text line, which is 0467 922 891. So without further ado, let's welcome back a man who is a great friend of this program, Kim Cirrus. So lovely to have you back in the studio.
Thanks, Deb, and thanks, Brett. It's really lovely to well, it is. It's rose time for everyone.
It is. It is indeed. Mine looking a little bit worse for wear, but we'll come to that later. So The Churchill Fellowship is what you've been on. Explain for people that don't understand what that is.
Prior to Winston Churchill's death, the Duke of Edinburgh said to him, what sort of legacy would you like to be remembered by? And he said he'd like to set up a system in Commonwealth countries where people were given the opportunity to travel the world and bring back information for the betterment of their communities or their industries. And Australia, New Zealand and Britain got organised. And since 1965, it's 60 years this year since the Churchill Fellowship has been inducted. So every year, about 100 people around Australia get the opportunity to travel around and from all types of industries and all types of organisations. And I think I was the only horticulturalist in what I'm classified as a 2023. So I travelled late last year and then wrote my report, which was 56 pages and 17,000 words. And wow. 2 weeks of my life I'll never get back. So,
2 weeks of your life in which you are going to tell us about the future of roses,
yes,
because Brett
and
I were having a discussion about it. We are keen to find out so many aspects of it.
Yeah, and Kim, and on that journey, you know, you had a fantastic opportunity to, you know, to visit and meet and talk to rose breeders and growers from right around the world. Yeah. And, you know, there are changes happening in the rose world, aren't there? And you know, they're not always obvious straight away here in Australia because we're a relatively small market compared to some of the other markets. But, you know, what are some of the things that you actually saw and maybe learned from that journey?
Well, I was away for 7 weeks, and the reason I applied for a Churchill Fellowship was to look at the way we are traditionally growing roses and how we can change, because I could see in America 70% of the roses that are sold are grown on their own roots. They're not budded. And that's quite a telling amount. So, I mean, they grow around about sort of 30-odd million roses over there, and 70% is a lot, and that's growing. And I really wanted to see how we could transition in our own growing here in ground growers, because everybody's been looking at wanting to change, and it's just really trying to find that pathway. And so really that was the whole idea.
And Kim, for gardeners and listeners that might not know what a budded rose is, I mean, a budded rose is where you get some budwood and you graft it to a rootstock. I mean, that's
yeah,
basically
essentially we've got. I mean, the growers have to they have to grow rootstocks. They have to then cut those rootstocks. They then have to take all the little eyes off each rootstock, because wherever there's a leaf that hits the roots and hits the stem, that's where a bud grows. So you've really got to do a lot of work to initially plant the stick. Then you've got to go and cut budwood, so that's a flower, and then you have to have a skilled worker to come in and actually take that bud off that stick, graft it onto the understock. There's a lot of work in roses, and I mean, I don't think, and you're right, people don't appreciate the amount of work to do that, and it's hard getting those skilled workers. I mean, we only talk about skilled workers across every industry. The rose industry is exactly the same. So by doing this, we can look at how we can then transition into less work to still produce a really good plant.
Yeah, so those roses then in America, which are growing on their own roots, or they're cutting growing, are they just as good a rose? Are they just as hardy, or are they better than, say, a budded rose?
Well, I spent a lovely afternoon with the West Jersey Rose Society having apple cake, and everyone was telling me how important it is to grow roses on their own roots, and they would not grow a budded rose. Now, they're in a situation where it gets very cold in winter, and if a plant dies at the top, if it's an own root rose, anything that shoots from the bottom is that plant, whereas if it's budded and the top dies and the rootstock grows, well, that's what you know, the sucker issue there. They also said because it is a rose that is itself, anything that does shoot from the bottom is the same plant. So there is no suckers. They're easier to sort of cut back. And if you really want to shear them back, and I mean, I cut back 2,000 roses at the nursery during winter with a chainsaw. It took me 5 seconds to prune a rose and a minute and a half to pick up all the clippings, and that was just by myself. And I have to say, everything's just shot away and looking good. So that may be another talk back issue. So let's see. Yeah, we won't start.
Getting a lot of questions, but can I ask, what is the historical reason then for us here in Australia growing our roses on rootstock?
Yeah, it's a really interesting one. There was a rose called La France, which was really seen as the first hybrid tea. It was sort of a weakish rose, but it had great value. So by putting anything onto a rootstock, the rootstock's like the engine room. So if something doesn't produce a good enough root system on its own, you can hook it onto another rootstock and then all of a sudden it powers away. But it also means that you can actually mass produce things very, very quickly. So there is a historic reason. And I did ask that question, Deb, to a lot of people, and there was a lot of head scratching. And
because we've always done it that way.
And that's what I really wanted to try to say, you know, do we have to do it this way?
Yeah, excellent point.
Yeah. Now, Kim, just over a week ago, there was a seminar held in Adelaide on the Australian rose industry, and you were the main driving force behind this seminar, really, and it comes off the back of what you saw and what you learnt in your fellowship. Just tell us a little bit about, you know, what happened on that particular day, there were rose growers from right around Australia that actually came to Adelaide. And it's the first of its kind in 50 years.
Yes.
You were saying,
I think in over 50 years, we have a lovely industry, but we're a little bit fragmented. So, trying to get everyone into one room is very, very difficult. But it was partly that dissemination of the Churchill Fellowship, where I'd been, what I'd learnt, and opening up a little bit of an ideas, you know, a catalogue to say, here's some opportunities if we want to go down that track. And everybody runs their own business, and I mean, I respect that, but the way people have been speaking, everybody wants to do some changes. It's about how we go about it. So firstly is to get everyone in the room, and then we start to have a better connection. And then it's really important is about the knowledge sharing, and that is probably going to be critical, and the testing and trialing, because we want to know, as growers want to know, is it going to work? And if it is going to work, what are the benefits to the home, you know, the end user, so the home gardener? And I think we're well down the track, because after the seminar, and we had 50 plus people, which is great, and thanks to the Adelaide Botanic Gardens for their support as well. We were really I was just a buzz, and I think the last session where I just handed the microphone around, and everybody got an opportunity to talk. It was sort of a bit electric, and it made me feel as though people asked me, "Was it what you wanted?" And I said, "Everything and more." Yeah,
and actually, I was fortunate enough to be there, and that last discussion at the end of the day was incredibly robust. I mean, it was incredibly respectful. There was lots of different opinions in the room, but it was fantastic to hear the passion and the sharing of knowledge and the willing to want to all move together. in sort of the same direction rather than going off in all directions. But it really was something special. Yeah, wasn't it? And it was just because these people are passionate about what they do. They run very busy businesses and they don't necessarily get an opportunity to share that amongst themselves, which I just found really, really heartwarming.
Yeah.
And there are people who get to work at 6 a.m. and leave at 6 p.m. or 7 p.m. and, you know, it's 6 days a week and... Yeah, there's not a lot of opportunities really to converse with others in the industry. So this was a really lovely, and it was wonderful during the breaks. I thought that was the special part where you could see people who'd heard of somebody and then they were there talking together. So it was lovely.
Bringing people together, and that's exactly what you're doing now, Kim Cirrus, because we've got a lot of phone calls for you. So we'll try and get through as many as we possibly can. But just before we move to them, Pat Toolan from Cainton says, I received a Churchill Fellowship in 2002 to investigate the preservation and conservation techniques and strategies of old rose and plant varieties in cemeteries. I'm always looking for old roses in Australia. Several found roses have been identified and have been reintroduced to Australian gardens. You're nodding your head. You obviously know Pat.
She's a champion of the heritage rose. So, yes, hello, Pat.
Brilliant. Your calls are what we are doing next. 1-300-222-891. We've got wonderful rosarian Kim Cirrus with us. We've got wonderful guest gardener Brett Draper, both here to answer your questions.
Talk Back Gardening
on ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill.
We have got in the studio our guest at Talk Back Garden today, Brett Draper, and rosarian, rose importer, Churchill Fellowship. What do you say, awardee or?
Churchill Fellow.
Churchill Fellow, Kim Cirrus.
I think the awards ceremony is in November the 14th, so I actually get my little medal.
Oh, which is fantastic. Yeah. Wear it with pride.
Thank you.
Andrew from Myland, you're first up this morning. What would you like advice on?
Good morning, Deb, Brett and Kim. I've got quite a few standard Camp David roses put in. They've been in for about 18 months now and into their second flowering as we speak. Is there anything I could do to enhance their aroma? Because they're slightly fragranted. And I was looking for a bit more.
Yeah, Camp David's not your highest of the fragrance rose, red roses, and that's just as is. And there really isn't much you can do. I mean, apart from keep up regular fertilising, regular watering, and enhancing their flowering capacity, which means more flowers, more fragrance, per flower. There's nothing you're going to be able to do to enhance the individual fragrance. But I would say when a bloom finishes, just snap it off or cut it back a little bit. That's called deadheading, and that will encourage the next flush of flowers for something like a Camp David.
So Andrew may need to buy a different, more fragrant rose to add to his garden if he wants to.
Yeah,
get
I mean
more.
Things like there's a new Papa Mayonde out there as well. So there's an opportunity to branch out into the new world of red fragrant roses.
Oh, Andrew, there you go. I love my Mr. Lincoln. I know it's an old one, but it's a good one. Sharon is in Coromandel Valley. Hi, Sharon.
Hello, how are you?
Well, thanks.
Good morning. First-time caller, so that's a bit nervous.
Oh, welcome. Don't be nervous. Become a long-time caller.
I listen all the time.
Great.
Deb, I've previously had a lot of roses and I've been asked to help a property in Macclesfield where my son's getting married in April. The roses have been quite unloved for a while but got sort of seriously pruned back by somebody else during winter. I guess my main question is, they're very old. How can I force a bloom? I've only ever deadheaded my roses and enjoyed the blooms as they come, but I want to try and force a bit of a special bloom for mid-April in Macclesfield.
Yep, okay. It's about working backwards, so work about 8 weeks before the event. I would just get the snips out and do a little light prune across just about a third of the bush. Then go back about 7 weeks before the event, do the next third, and then about 6 weeks before the event and do the final third. So what you're doing is you're giving yourself a bit of an insurance, because if you get a really hot burst, if you've cut back 8 weeks beforehand, you may find that everything just flowers really quickly, and then mm-hmm. the event goes, and then you get there and everyone says, yeah, the flowers must have been great a couple of weeks ago. whereas if you do it in stages, you're going to give yourself there will be some flowers. It's not going to be completely massed in flowers, but it will still look really good. And just regular watering, regular feeding, just good deep soaks, and those roses will really look they'll be terrific.
Thank you. So you're saying to take a third of the bush off, including all the flowers?
Yes.
At eight weeks, seven weeks, and six.
And then what that is, when I say it's just really just, you can use a pair of head shears if you like and just do a little clop here and a little clop there, not just one third, yeah. but just work your way around and to just
so you're
take
staggering
a bit,
the growth, basically, stagger. Aren't you, Kim? You're staggering the growth, and what you're doing is creating a situation where, because you don't know how warm the weather's going to be,
yep.
where some will be in lovely growth, some will be in bud, and some will be in flower.
Yes.
So you've got an overall nice-looking plant for that particular time. Mm.
Sharon, that is awesome. Good luck for your son's wedding, and I hope the blooms do bloom on the right day for you with that advice from Kim and Brett. So thanks very much for calling in and joining the Talkback Gardening family. Hopefully we'll hear from you regularly now. Anne is in Inman Valley, and you're a bit late in pruning.
Yes, good morning, everyone. I pruned late this year. It wasn't till August. And I've got standard roses which have just shot away, which is what I was not trying to achieve. I was trying to achieve more, less growth because they're already up higher than the fence. So I've got the first flush happening. Can I prune after they finish the first flush? Can I prune them back down again to try and get them, keep them down?
Yes, you can. I just wouldn't prune them down too far, because if you prune them down too far, you may just get a whole lot of new strong growth coming. So by just, say, nipping off maybe a quarter of that top, it just means that everything that's left, there'll be nice even growth rather than really cutting it back hard and leaving a couple of buds that will just shoot away, so you'll be back up to where you are again. So I just think a little lighter prune after that flush, or just cut the flower heads off, that's really all you'll need to do.
And thank you very much. I'm sure you're not alone in that. I'm putting my hand up for it as well. And Deb in Toorak is next. What have you got on your roses, Deb?
Morning. I'll be quick because I know there's a long queue. So I'll sort of describe it. I don't know the proper name, but also I just want to mention I'm an organic gardener. It's white. It's like, I wouldn't say it's scale. It's this white sort of fluffy stuff. It almost looks like cobwebs, I suppose, on sort of the branches of my, or the stems of my Lorraine Lee. And I know it's a pest. I just can't seem to get on top of it.
Yes, that's woolly aphid you've got through there. And if you just use a horticultural oil and just spray that under 30 degrees, and there's a couple of brands out there, they're really good. Do not use white oil, please.
Right.
White oil is winter. Yeah. Winter. If it's really thick, and it can actually burn holes in your foliage, as we found out down the nursery a couple of years ago. Horticultural oils are really refined, and just a nice dose of those. And it is a contact only. So, and if you're an organic gardener, you'll love your horticultural oils.
And one thing I've experienced with woolly aphid is that because of that woolly coating on them, you really need to saturate them. So when you spray with your horticultural oil, really, really saturate them, because that you need to break down that protective coating, you like, if they've got on the outside of them.
And how often do you reckon?
Do your first dose, and then just assess it as required. You probably get a 70% kill rate for your first rush, and then every 2 weeks is probably no closer than 2 weeks.
Mm. Deb, good luck with your white woolly scale. Colin is in Hallett Cove. Colin, you've got a passion for a particular rose.
I've got a cardinal rose, long stem. This year, the perfume is not there. My wife used to cut the flower and bring it inside, and it'd go right through the house. But this year, I don't know what I've done, why it hasn't got the perfume. I'm just wondering why.
Perfume is sort of, it can be a bit... well, everyone has a different sense of smell, and you're saying that it's dropped away. Look, sometimes it can be the cold. You know, when you go out to smell a rose in the morning, right in the early morning, and you go and smell that rose mid-afternoon, you'll have a totally different fragrance on it because all those perfume oils. They're volatile oils, and they need the heat to actually be released. So if you're cutting your flowers really early in the morning, you're sticking inside, you may not have the amount of oil that really is permeated. So I would say cut the roses a little bit later. Keep up your watering, keep up your feeding and everything else. But I reckon it might be just temperature dependent.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. So, Kim, in that case then, you know, if we'd had more consistent heat, or we're going to hopefully get more consistent heat, that you would think should improve?
Yeah. You go to Morocco where they pick all the petals for the rose attar, and they start at about 4 a.m. and they're finished by 8. Because once they've gone past that, the oil is starting to be released from the petals. So they have to gather it whilst it's cold in the morning. Then they go through their distillation process. And then next morning they're out again to pick the roses.
And so the oil releases the fragrance. Mm. So it's why in the afternoon you really get the smell of a rose, but in the morning you don't. And that's so interesting.
Yeah.
Brilliant. Colin, thank you very much for calling in. We're getting so many fantastic photographs of roses. Honestly, I know that you both can't see them, but Alex from Broadview says, my bush is so heavy with flowers, it's bending over. It's been a good year this year. I've been sent through 7 photographs of entirely different and beautiful rose breeds, but the texter that sent them said, what can I do for powdery mildew?
Well, if you want to go down the organic, 10% milk and a 10% milk solution, so 1 part milk, 10 parts water, is really good for powdery mildew. You just have to reapply it every sort of 7 days. But the best thing really is good fertilizer that's a dedicated rose fertilizer that has decent amounts of potassium, because potash is an element that is a strengthening element, and the better that is, the more well-fed a rose is, the better it is at warding off a lot of issues like powdery mildew. I mean, some roses I know are prone to it, but if you keep up your feeding, keep up your watering, and with a dedicated rose food that has got a good amount of potassium, and they do because that's part of their makeup, you'll find that your rose does so much better, and keep it regularly. My tip for fertilising, do your fertilising. Start off at the beginning of spring with whatever it says on the pack, and then half the amount every month until around about April. That's just my little tip as a rose grower, because roses are sort of what we call gross feeders. They just like to be fed, and look at me. I mean, yeah, I'm probably one of those. I'm a gross feeder myself, actually. But if you keep that up, you just keep up the balance of nutrients all the way through, and it's surprising how better flowering, better performing your plants will be.
Great advice. Rosemary from Kensington says, it's so wonderful to hear about the rose development. I'm watching the new standard 80-centimetre double delights start to flower across the front wall of my new unit. The second one is out. It's a total delight. Such a treat to hear everybody talking about roses. And I'm asking Kim Sirius, are you able to stay with us?
Yes, I certainly can.
Okay. Thank you so much, Kim, because we have already got more questions on the phone line. So Janice, Sandra and others, please hang on the line. We will definitely take your calls. Bev says, I urge all to try and grow a rose. I can't believe how tough they are. I came back to South Australia, planted some in my first house, moved to another house, dug them up into pots, planted them again in the wrong sunspot, dug them up again, and I've never had a garden soil. Some I've dug up 5 times in 3 years. All are still flowering and powering away. On you, Bev. Well done.
Yep, more power to the rose.
Absolutely. We are Talkback Gardening with our special Talkback Gardener, Brett Draper. Joining us also is Rosarian Rose Importer Churchill Fellow Kim Sirius. We'd love to take your calls on 1300 222 891. We love your comments as well on the text line 0467 922 891.
Talkback Gardening
on ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill.
Good morning and welcome to Talk Back Gardening. Good morning, Brett Draper.
Good morning, Deb.
Lovely to have you in the chair today for Sophie Thompson, who will be back next week. And also joining us in the studio is Churchill Fellow, Rosarian, Rose Importer, Garden Commentator, you name it, Kim Cirrus. Kim, lovely to have you with us in the studio.
Wonderful to be here, Deb and Brett.
We've got some rose questions, but we'll also take your questions on any general Talk Back Gardening. So the number to call is 1300 222 891. I have a couple of ABC Organic Gardener magazines to give away a little later in the program, and we also welcome your comments on our text line, which is 0467 922 891. Let's dive straight in with Sandra from Hackham. You've got some questions on pruning, climbing and standard roses. Sandra, welcome.
Oh, good morning, everyone. Yes, you get your plant from the nursery, you pot it on, and then your climbing rose is on a trellis or obelisk, and your standard is in a pot on a stake. If you want, I've heard that you can really manipulate a rose. So for a climbing rose, do you sacrifice the flowers for the first 3 years to get the shape that you want? We're not sure what to do.
That's a really good question. In terms of, you said that's on an obelisk?
Because my friend has bought so many roses, and the criteria is beautiful, fragrant roses. We don't have enough space in the garden, so they've got to go in pots. But we've also got a trellis in the front garden, and we're planting a Bathsheba one side and a Princess Margarita the other.
Mm-hmm. With a climbing rose, and it is one of those, it's a bit of a mystery for a lot of people. It's like the dark art of pruning. With the climbing rose, it's important not to prune it like a bush rose, because every time you cut, if you cut it back really hard, all the growth that comes generally in the autumn is what the rose will start flowering off in the spring. So if you just simply cut everything back, you'll start with maybe none or just a few little roses here and there. So it's important to keep as many of those long canes and try to weave them around. That's probably the critical thing, because if you let a climbing rose cane just go straight up in the air, it will only generally flower right at the tip where it starts to bend, because the more horizontal you can put a climbing cane into, the more flowers you'll get. And Brett,
can I just jump in there? So, Kim, you're talking about more horizontal. So that is changing, I guess, the sap flow within the plant. Mm. And those buds that are horizontal then will have more vigour and more energy, and probably that's where they're going to flower from more than if it's just going vertically.
Yeah. And if you have an obelisk, that's hard, because against a fence, it's easier to do something. But with an obelisk, it's about winding it around. So as you're winding it, it is you're bringing it into a little bit more of a horizontal sort of space. So if you've got loads and loads and loads of climbing canes that are there when you come to do your pruning, you can sacrifice plenty of those and just keep sort of maybe a third of those that really will fill up that obelisk.
Yeah, and one of the things I learned, actually Walter Duncan taught me this technique, because he's obviously had lots and lots of different types of roses, but on his, they've got at the Heritage Garden, there's 22 archways of Souvenir de la Maison, I think that's how you say it.
Yes.
And he wanted flowering right over the archway. And so when you had a collection of canes, and they were tied to these archways rather than being woven around, so when you undid the ties, it just went boing, it just went everywhere. But you pruned each cane at a different level to ensure that you had growth and flowering points at different levels, so you got flowers right over the arch. Mm.
That's why I say it's a bit of a dark art with climbers. Look, I think the important thing is just retain as much as you of the climbing canes as you can come pruning time, and wind them around.
Let's hope you become proficient in the dark arts there, Sandra. Thank you very much for calling. Janice is in Klemzig, and you've got a Francis Xavier rose question, Janice.
Yes, I've got probably about six planted alternately with Francis du Braille. The Francis Xaviers, they just... I get lots of nice buds. They turn brown and just die mostly. So I don't know what the problem is, really.
Okay.
They're quite old, I should say.
How many years has that plant been? I mean, what sort of age would you say?
They'd be 20 plus.
Mm. Yeah.
the Francis de Rail are fine.
Yeah, and look at the, and that goes through. There's loads of different varieties that will last longer than others, and so they, you know, there is a natural sort of cut off date for some roses. But you know, going back, you know, what's your watering like? I mean, what are you doing in terms of your watering and your feeding for those particular varieties?
Well, I use a rose feed, well-known one. I have a sprinkler system, well, not sprinklers, drippers, which I water, well, especially in summer, you know, at least twice a week, probably more sometimes, depending on the weather.
Okay.
At the moment, I'm not really watering because of the rain.
What I might suggest is save up that watering that you would do two or three times a week and just put it on once, but for the same length of time. Now, a dripper, and the one thing about drippers, is this the brown tube dripper type things, or is it a different with an emitter?
No, the old-fashioned kind.
Yeah, with an emitter.
Yeah.
I mean, they generally run at around about sort of 2 to 4 litres an hour. So if you think about 2 to 4 litres, and that's half a bucket, well, you know, a third to a half a bucket of water. If I said that an average rose needs around about one bucket of water per plant per week, that gives you a bit of a clue as to how much water, and it's best to make sure that it's taken in slowly and the water goes down, and that just helps to drought-proof the plant. And I think you'll see an improvement in those roses that aren't looking that great at the moment. I feel sure that there will be an improvement. However, it might be that after 20-plus years, it's time to maybe review or an opportunity. I mean, 25 years, there's a lot of... That's good service, isn't it, for a plant? And
the problem is that we've got huge council trees, so it's very difficult to plant anything.
Okay, well, therein lies a point, is that it's what's coming into that garden and just really robbing your lovely roses. And you might even chat to the council and see if they will offer a service of a root barrier between your house and the trees. Some councils do that.
And with that, Kim, I guess with that extra competition that you've got for nutrient and water, that's there, it would be more important that when you water to make a nice deep watering, make that watering count.
Yes.
Yeah, because the tree's just going to be robbing that away, and you want the rose to get the benefit from that.
And roses, as you said, they do need more water than we think they do. Sometimes we just think roses can just go, can't they?
But they do need their water. If you put the water in the right way, they're incredibly drought tolerant. They are one of the best drought tolerant plants, flowering plants in that category, if you get the watering right. And that's deep soaks, maybe once a week, a really good deep soak.
And we're talking in summer, aren't we?
In summer, and a mulch. Wow. So maybe Deb, yours.
Yes. Well, I had beautiful, beautiful roses for the weeks that I was doing exactly that.
Yes.
And then life got too busy, and I haven't done a deep water for the last 8 or 9 days. And of course, Where are the roses going? They're looking pretty sad, so I need to get home and give them a big soak. Janice, good luck with that. Lots of ideas there for you. And don't forget, you can ring in with your general talkback gardening calls as well. We have got time for that on 1300 222 891. Let's go to Kirsty in Gawler. Kirsty, you've got a standard rose with some sort of leaf curl. Good morning.
Good morning. It's actually a lot of roses. We've got 46 standard roses of varying varieties. They're 2 years old, and last year they did well. And then this year they've come out in leaf, and then all the leaves started to curl, and I thought maybe they were dry. And when we had a look at the soil, it was still moist from the winter. And then all those leaves curled up and everything fell off and it went brown and everything looked very sick. And I just don't know how to proceed, I guess, because I went to the nursery and about 8 of them have recovered, but the rest are looking very sad still. And I don't know if it's something about the soil, do I need to replace them, or was it a chemical? I just don't know, and the nursery couldn't really give me any information either.
Okay. Did anyone go using a herbicide spray during the winter to knock off any weeds and the like?
No, I don't believe so. I'm on an acreage, but I don't think our neighbours would use anything like that either in the area. So whether it was a drift, I don't know.
Yeah, because, I mean, to me, it's a real worry. If everything's going, if everything has dropped their leaves, to me that sounds either a soil like a pythium or something in that ground, and that's you don't want to think about that. But and the roses had been there for how many years?
Only
two.
So they've had, but they had a full year last year, and they did everything,
and they were fine
as they should, and were quite healthy. I mean, one side's a little bit more healthy than the other because the others run alongside of big trees, but the other side, you know, so depending on where they are in the rose garden, they've still done well.
And so this curling or the affecting of the leaves came out on the plant as they got their new growth, or was it after they got that growth?
I don't walk past this area all the time, but when I saw them come out in new growth, it looked to be normal growth, and then it started. Then I went out there later and found that they were kind of curled up, and that's why I thought maybe they were thirsty, but yeah.
Yeah, it does sort of sound like something in the environment has affected them, and whether it is a drift of some kind. Do you have vineyards and things near you being in the Barossa?
I'm in Gawler, but no, not really. But yeah, I guess it could come from over that way. I don't know how far that drifts, but
And when you took a sample into the nursery or garden centre, were they able to give you any clues looking at the foliage at all?
Well, they said when it curls, it's protecting itself, the plant, and then they said at one point they said, oh, it's too dry. Then they said, oh, no, maybe it's wet because we do sort of have clay-like soil here. And then they said it could be chemicals, so I'm still none the wiser.
Yeah, and I think we're none the wiser either, to be honest. I'd love to give you the solution to your question, but it does sound to me like that it has been affected by something in the environment. And roses at time can be quite sensitive to chemicals, particularly weed sprays, if they've got a little bit of a drift on the plant. Yeah. And it does take a while. It's not enough necessarily to kill the plant, but it's enough to actually get into the plant and cause mutations and all sorts of funny things happen within the plant. And usually they grow through that, don't they, Kim, as long as it hasn't been too bad.
Yeah, and look, the rule of thumb is if something is looking bad, you just cut it back, and cut it back as hard as it, well, you know, relatively hard to then encourage the next lot of shoots to come through. So if something's affected your root system and your root system's been damaged, the idea is to reduce the top growth that it needs to support. So I'd say the only thing I could suggest at this stage is try and cut back what you've got to see if you can encourage a new shoot, you know, group of shoots. But I'm really concerned about that.
Yeah, well, look, I'm sorry, Kirsty, but good luck with it. Sounds like there's been a major problem there. Heather is in Marion. Heather, you have roses growing on a rootstock with a different coloured rose.
That's right. I've got some pink roses and there's a lot of them. And there's one coming through with red roses on it.
Yeah, okay. Fantastic.
The rootstock coming through. What do I do with it?
If you leave it and let it go, that red rose is going to take over because the rootstock is the powerhouse. And eventually your lovely pink rose will just disappear into this, you know, into this sort of mire of red roses. Find out where that stem's coming from and try to tear it off. It's really hard. So if it gets too big, and it's very hard to tear off. So if it's just started, find out where the rootstock's coming from, that red rose. It'll be below the graft. It might even be in the ground. Dig around, and if you can tear it off, you get a much better option of removing it than just simply cutting it. So if you simply cut it, what will happen is it won't be one stem next year. It'll be about six stems coming up. So really try to get as low as you possibly can to sort of wrench it out, and if you've got a crowbar or something, that helps to just, you know, get it in the nape of where it's coming from and just give it a real hit.
You pull a heel off, don't you? You pull that bit off and that.
But what happens if Heather can't find that bit and you have to just snip it with your secateurs?
Then you do what most people do who've got lots of suckers on roses, is you just keep cutting them back.
Okay.
Heather, it's a very common problem, so thank you very much. We'll take a last call on roses before we let Kim Cirrus leave, and that is from Annie in Gawler. Hi, Annie. What's your question?
Just quickly, two questions. We've got really rock hard clay soil. I'd like a suggestion for the best roses for that. And also, the other side of the drive, we've got dichondra and there's weeds coming through. Can you put weed and feed on that?
I'll do the dichondra first. No. No, right. Sorry, you can't. So dichondra has a broader leaf, and the active ingredients in weed and feed, which control, and any of your, those type of products which control broadleaf weeds, will actually kill your dichondra as well. Unfortunately, there's really nothing selective you can apply to remove those weeds on dichondra, so that's a little bit of a hand weeding exercise, that one.
Yep. And roses are the only thing that will really grow well here with the rock hard soil, and I'm just wondering what the best, are they different roses for different conditions?
Well, most roses are budded, and they're budded onto a rootstock, and if it's and the rootstock generally is a thing called Dr. Huey, and it loves clay. It absolutely loves it. So any rose that you buy from a garden centre is light, and it's a budded variety, is likely to be budded onto a Dr. Huey rootstock. And so as you've seen, your roses are growing well. They're all on the same type of rootstock. Even though the top is different, that's the graft, but the base and the root system is going to be pretty well the same, and that's why they do so well. And in that horrible clay rocky stuff that you've got.
So hopefully the roses will be coming up for you in Gawler, Annie. Thank you very much. Thank you so much to the many texters, and I can't thank you all individually because there are so many of them who have sent through your beautiful photographs of roses or are saying that you're enjoying the conversation about roses, and thank you very much for your feedback there. We can't get to all of your questions today, I'm afraid. Kim Sirius, Churchill Fellowship SA Rosarian, has to leave us shortly, but not before. Brett, you just ask him a quick question.
I'd love to ask one quick question. And look, the information today has been fantastic. But Kim, you know, just going back to the seminar, the Australian Rose Industry seminar that was held just a little while ago, and particularly at the end of that seminar when we were talking about the discussion that was in the room and the growers, and you know, we're talking about really what is the future of roses, and that's really what today was all about. We've sort of gone off on a little bit of a tangent today, but, you know, it was sort of, you know, people were talking about, or growers were talking about some of the things that they're doing, and you know, and there was a suggestion in the room, you know, that there could be, you know, a potted colour rose, for instance, you know, something that might be something that's almost treated like an annual, if you like, in a lot of ways, or you know, might be a perennial for 2 or 3 years, where someone can get, you know, a small rose which flowers for a long period of time that they can have in a pot, in a courtyard or in a balcony or in a small space, for instance, and you know, something which they can enjoy that doesn't require much pruning or deadheading or any of that sort of maintenance. You know, what's your thoughts around there? Is that something that's achievable?
Yes. Or? Well, I think the future of roses has to have a couple of different pathways. And one is our traditional roses that we see now, but we also need to encourage a new generation and new generations into the rose sort of sphere. And a lot of it has to do with just good-looking plants and plants that have just got that wow factor to them, without necessarily being a cutting rose that you would stick in a vase, but they're more use. So if, as gardens get smaller, we need to have roses that sort of pack a punch and pack a flowering punch. So perhaps, you know, in that smaller growing, a little bit like the rose that won the gold medal, unnamed. It's actually called Brick House in America. Now, Brick House is a dunny in Australia.
Yes.
So I've got a funny feeling. I mean, maybe we can start a new trend, you know, the dunny rose. But I'll have to come up with another name. But that's the sort of – that's what you're looking into. When you go into that troll garden, you're looking into the future of roses. And every rose that you see in that troll garden, the first cross is 10 to 12 years ago. It's not 2 years ago. It's the long process. So what we're seeing is it's going to be that smaller, lots of flowers, low maintenance, and people just enjoying something in the garden. As I said, different generations, and as people, you know, go along their rose path, they may move to your traditional style roses, but we certainly want to encourage people into looking at roses as a just a easy to grow, loads of flowers, and I mean, Adelaide and South Australia, what a great place to grow roses.
You are absolutely right. Great place to leave it. Kim Cirrus, thank you so much for coming in. Congratulations on your Churchill Fellowship, and thank you for telling us about it this morning.
Thanks, Deb, and thanks, Brett.
Thank you. Brett Draper is our Talkback Gardener, standing in for Sophie Thompson today. We'd love your calls on 1300 222 891. If you haven't won anything from 891 ABC Radio Adelaide or your local ABC radio station in the last month and you'd like to win an ABC gardening magazine, call in now on 1300 222 891 or text in with your full name and postal address to 0467 922 891.
Talkback Gardening with Deb Tribe on ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill.
Wouldn't be much of a talkback gardening if it was just me, that's for sure. Brett Draper is our special guest gardener this morning. And if you've got a general talkback gardening call, please call through on 1300 222 891. Sarah from the Barossa joins us. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning. I want to start a compost heap, and I don't know, should I buy just one of those black bin things, or is a tumbler machine thing better?
Mm-hmm. Yep. So I guess, Sarah, the I guess the question is what you can actually manage. I mean, there's many ways that you can make compost, and there's many ways that you can, or many devices that you can actually use. So if you're looking at a pre-made compost bin, for instance, and tumblers are quite good in that they allow you to turn the material quite easily, because the composting process requires a couple of things, but one of the most important things is air. It requires plenty of air movement within the compost, because that's what the microbes need to get to be able to, you know, to be able to break down the material that's in there. So it really probably doesn't matter what sort of device that you're actually going to put them into, or what sort of structure you're going to put them into, but it's more important that you make sure that it gets plenty of air and you turn the actual compost regularly. Look, I know people that use old pallets, for instance, and stand them on their sides and put droppers in them to hold them up, because that allows air through, and they put the compost material, their garden clippings and green waste and shredded papers and material in there.
I was thinking about building one of these, but we're not a large family, so we don't have a huge amount of compost, but there's, you know, food scraps and there's grass clippings from mowing.
Yeah.
And I guess I could put some shredded newspaper in there.
And the other really important thing is to layer it. So when you put a layer of green material in, you need to put a layer of dry material. So the shredded paper or the straw or dry leaves or something. So you've because the other thing you also don't want is to be too wet. You need to get the balance between it being moist but not too wet, but with plenty of air.
So can I put dog poo in the compost heap?
It's probably not recommended, not normally, if you're going to be using that on your vegetable beds. But what you can do is pop them into your organic green waste bins, because those materials are composted at a really high temperature.
Yeah,
that's correct. So that they ensure that, you know, they reach 70 plus degrees when they're composting those, which kills weed seeds and lots of other pathogens in the actual compost. There are people that have, you can actually buy pet composting units, which are separate to what you would do for household compost that you might use on your vegetable patch, for instance. So
what about things like chicken bones? Can they go in the compost, or should they go in the green bin?
Yeah, well, look, they can. They'll take a long time to break down. So again, I in my experience, when I've put them in my compost, I generally find them, you know, when I put the compost out, I still find them in the garden 2 or 3 years later. So I actually do put them into the green waste bin. It really depends on how long you can compost the material for and how hot you can get the compost. And for most home gardeners, they don't are not able to get it hot enough for long enough to break down all of those things completely. So I would suggest maybe things like bones and things that you pop them into your organic green waste.
Well, thank you for your time.
Thank you for your call, Sarah. Lovely to hear from you. Congratulations to our magazine winners this week, Irene in Hove and Shona in Port Augusta. We'll send out those to you sometime this week. Thank you to the many people who sent through beautiful pictures of roses. Beck from Victor, out of my garden, to you. Someone saying that there is a lovely display of roses and other blooms today at the Kingscote show. So oh, thanks for letting us know that. This texter says, I wish there was a way of preserving all the old varieties of roses for people to purchase instead of fashions and economics dictating current availability. I think all roses should have a scent, especially the strong ones. Well, it's about what's going to survive into the future, isn't it? That's really what we've been talking about this morning.
It is. And one of those important things, Deb, is that roses, and particularly in the trial, out of the trial garden, are roses with scent. They actually often rate quite high because people not only want a showy, wow type rose with a beautiful flower, but if it's got a perfume as well, it just adds that extra dimension. And the perfume of a rose, like many plants, is often very emotive. It brings back lots of lovely memories for people for whatever reason. So it's definitely something that you know, that's important in roses going forward.
It sure is. A lovely picture being sent through of a miniature rose in a pot for 12 years, which is lovely every year. Chameleon rose has been sent through looking absolutely lovely on somebody's front porch. Lily from Norwood says, on Thursday night, the possums ate all the flowers on my red Pierre de Ronsard and all the leaves of my Celsiana. Oh, that's a shame. Anyway, anti-possum tips. We are going to have James Smith from 4Nature in the studio, I'm sure, right, between now and the end of the year. There are a lot of possums around at the moment because their habitat is disappearing, so they are coming into our gardens. But look, so many of your beautiful roses, pictures and lovely, you know, mentions, particularly for you, Brett. Someone saying, lovely to hear Brett Draper. Really enjoy listening to Brett again. So I can only say thank you very much for coming in and being our guest Talkback Gardener this morning. Any issues you'd like to leave us with? Because not only are you a horticulturist, you're also a garden centre manager. A few big issues at the moment.
Yeah, there's just a couple of things. So soil temperatures, we'll just touch on quickly. They're going up really, really slowly. They're only in about 17.5 in Adelaide, so up only 0.5 from the previous week. I was hoping they might be up around the 18 or 19 mark by now, but it is warm enough to plant your tomatoes. So we've reached the magic 16 degrees and it's only going to get warmer from here.
Right.
And then one quick thing, lastly, is citrus gall wasp at the moment. So we know that the emergence has started. That started a couple of weeks ago. It was predicted that this week would be the peak emergence, but we've had up and down spring weather. So in areas where it's a little bit cooler, it is still happening. If you have sprayed your tree with kale and clay to protect your tree from being reinfected with the wasp laying eggs in it after the emergent, if you've sprayed it once, it's now time to give it a second spray. That's really important. We've had some showery weather in between. And when you apply the kale and clay mixture to your trees, it is recommended that you apply it 2 weeks apart. Now, the actual complete life cycle or emergence of the wasp is expected to be sort of mid-November. So if you get it on now, we're the 1st of November today, that should take you through until the end and hopefully protect your tree going into the future. And it's quite interesting too. You might find, even on the one tree, you'll find that maybe on, say, the warmer or the northern side of the tree, they might have started to emerge, but on the southern side where it's a little bit cooler, they may not have emerged just yet. So they're still coming out in a staggered emergence, if that makes sense.
Gee, aren't we lucky? Yeah. lots of people, I'm sure, have been flooding you for their kale and clay.
Yes, they have, yeah. And there's other measures out there as well. I mean, for trees that you can't spray, you can use the horticultural glue that's on there. But that's if you can reach the galls to paint them on too, and that traps them as they emerge.
Wonderful. Just coming back to the issue of compost that you were just talking about, Richard says the tumbleweed requires a strong operator. When it was half full, the load was so heavy it knocked the base out as it fell to the bottom. Yeah. So you do have to be aware of that sort of
thing. It's important not to overload it, definitely. Yeah. Yes.
Yep. Thanks for that, Richard. Thank you for all of your calls and texts. Brett Draper, thank you for being our guest Talkback Gardener today. It's been lovely having you in the studio.
It's been my pleasure, Deb. Until next time, happy gardening.